Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Can I just point out, before we go any further, Alex Gell at the back there, who organises everything in front of house and so forth, has just come back from a two-month residency playing as part of a ukulele orchestra in Dollywood, OK? Dollywood, Tennessee. So, if you... It's pretty good, isn't it? And
he's had a tattoo.
He's had a tattoo. He's had a crazy rock and roll tattoo, but it'll need the Hubble telescope to actually identify it. But he'll be happy later on to show you his picture that he had taken with Dolly, didn't you? Didn't you? That's pretty good. So there you go. So, right, welcome back to the second half of this Nielsen and Newman Word in Your Ear. And... It struck me at the end where we were talking about what made Harry Nielsen special. I think probably the same things made him special as make Randy Newman special. That they're sort of both artists with no antecedents and no successors. You know what I mean? Yeah. You can't imagine anybody doing what Harry Nielsen did now. I can't see anybody doing it. And I think when Randy Newman finally does shuffle off this mortal coil, I think you'll say, there went one of a kind, and there won't be anybody like him. And I'm delighted to say that his life and music has been chronicled and assessed in this new book called Maybe I'm Doing It Wrong, which is, of course, a famous Randy Newman song, by our next guest. Would you please welcome David and Caroline Stafford?
And we should start by asking...
We should. It's the first time we've had two people on the sofa
who've jointly written the same book.
Yeah.
How does that work? We've got no idea how the labour divides. I mean, I'm imagining one person researches and one person writes, but that's probably not the case at all.
No, it's not the case at all. On this one, it varies. I mean, we sort of do it rather piecemeal. On this one, Caroline did most of the first draft and most of the initial research, and then I took over for a bit... And then Caroline took over again, and then I took over again. And
then I took all his bits out then.
Yeah.
And gave it back to him.
She takes out all my knob jokes. And,
I wondered where they were. Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't.
It was a much longer book originally.
Exactly.
So, Caroline, can you get the microphone a bit closer to you, actually, so everybody can hear? Is that mic working okay? Caroline, just test that mic.
Yeah, you just got to hold it up.
Is it working okay? Fine.
Yes.
So, Caroline, tell us about the other stuff you've written together.
Our first book was about Lionel Bart.
But of course, Lionel Bart, and that was a Radio 4 Book of the Week, wasn't it?
A couple of years ago.
Very fine book.
And then we did Kenny Everett, who's a big friend of Harry Nielsen's. And then we did Adam Faith. And now it's Randy Newman.
Right.
Yeah.
So
he's alive.
Yes.
Which is a big difference.
So when you came up with the idea of doing something about Randy Newman, you went to the publisher, did they hats in the air? Whoopee, Randy Newman, that's pay dirt.
No, the publisher's there somewhere. His response was, Randy Newman, who's going to buy that? And
right.
So I think we said we knew at least four people.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there's more than four here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, they're not.
Yeah, but they came for Harry Nielsen. Yeah.
No.
And besides which, these look like people who've still got open libraries. So that we might get public lendings.
But presumably, you're long-standing fans, is that?
Absolutely.
Is that?
Oh yeah. I mean, I was trying to remember. I think I bought 12 songs. I didn't buy the first one, but I think I had 12 songs. I haven't got any of it now because it all got sadly nicked.
Right. Yes. Right. Has he read the book? Have you had any reaction from him?
No, he hasn't read it, as far as we know. We were in. I mean, part of the problem was that we were in negotiations with his management for about 6 months before we got the final. I don't think he's very keen on having a biography written about him, but good luck with it anyway.
Yeah.
So
encouraging.
So it's also very liberating, the idea that you're not going to have to talk to him, you're not going to have anything to do with him, yeah. Means that your views won't be compromised by reality.
Absolutely. At all. There's no red pencil going right through it.
The other thing that we discovered in the other books is that the worst possible witnesses to history are the people who lived through it. When you're talking, I mean, we had terrible ones with Adam Faith. I mean, these are people who've never taken drugs or drank very much in their life, but their memory is shot to pieces. So you would get these absolutely, bona fide stories that you'd give. There was one, a member of the Roulettes, I won't say which one, which was Adam Faith's backing group, told us a fascinating story about them all meeting up with the Beatles in a hotel in the Isle of Wight, and we copied this verbatim into the book. And then the publisher, the editor of the book, said the Beatles never played the Isle of Wight.
He meant the Baron Knight.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So we asked him, he said, oh, no, maybe it was Cliff Richard.
That's right. Yeah.
It's not quite the same. It's terrible. I've had this experience myself that somebody tells you a story, you think, brilliant. And, of course, you now have the internet.
Yeah.
Which enables you to go and check.
Oh, yeah.
And your heart sinks when it proves that they've just completely made it up.
And they can be wrong on dates by as much as 5 or 10 years.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And you have to check every single fact they come up with and then decide, what do I do now? Do I actually change the facts to, change what they said to fit the fact, or do we just leave it out?
And how good a story is it?
How good a story is it anyway?
Well, the great thing about Randy Newman as a subject is that he said a lot about himself.
Yeah, he's sung a lot about himself.
And he's always amusing about himself. Yeah, I've never heard a boring word from Randy Newman ever. So let's just go back to the beginnings here. This is a picture that people are familiar with. It's on the cover of one of his albums, Land of Dreams.
Right. Yeah.
And so this is him at the age of, seven or something like this.
Well, to quote Dixie Flyer, he was born right there, which is Los Angeles in November 43. Dad was a captain in the army fighting the Germans in Sicily. His poor little mama didn't know a soul in L.A., so she went down to the Union Station and made her getaway on the Dixie Flyer down to New Orleans. That's the first, that's how autobiographically, you can virtually get access to his online bank account with those sorts of details.
So, but similar to Harry Nilsson, they're kind of wartime kids, aren't they?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, and he didn't see his dad really for the first 2 years of his life. He lived in New Orleans with his mom. And in fact, that tension between Los Angeles and New Orleans is there for the rest of his life. He sees himself as half Southern, even though he's actually lived in LA all his life. He used to go back to New Orleans quite frequently to see his grandparents when he was a child.
His childhood couldn't be more different from Harry Nilsson. I mean, nobody passed dud checks or anything like that. They were a very wealthy family. The whole family was fantastically
wealthy. But he was kind of unhappy, though, wasn't he? There's a bit early on which seems so inconsistent with everything that happened later on, his character, because he had four operations on his eyes, didn't he?
He had born with a squint, had a lot of operations on his eyes, was basically bullied at school, and he wore these thick pebble glasses. Track two of Land of Dreams is called Four Eyes. And it's about being bullied at school and being taunted in the playground. So he was an unhappy, unsociable,
and constantly crashing cars.
Yeah.
So someone who had deficient eyesight and was also drinking heavily.
Well, the idea of putting somebody with defective eyesight and a drink problem behind the wheel of a car when he was 16.
Only in America.
His dad let him drive the car. His dad was a doctor and a celebrity doctor. His clients, do you call it patients, included Pat Boone and Oral Roberts and Rod Stewart, I think. Billy Joel was one of Dr. Newman's patients. So he had a lot of secrets on them, but he never divulged them.
Uncles.
And look at this.
So
there's his uncles, right. Yeah. Randy was born into Hollywood royalty. This man here is Alfred Newman, who is the most revered Hollywood composer of all time. Every time you go and see a 20th Century Fox film, it opens with that fanfare. Uncle Alfred wrote that.
Right.
He was nominated for 40 Oscars. He won 9 Oscars. in some years he was, you know, all of the music Oscars, it was just him. You know, he was just all the nominations.
And a difficult man.
There are various. He had a wonderful argument with Charlie Chaplin. He had no time for losers. Not losers. He had no time for time wasters. Does that make sense? He was a great conductor, and he formed the 20th... In those days, the studios had their own orchestra, huge orchestras on the payroll. And he formed the 20th Century Fox Orchestra. The Newman Strings, as they were called, were legendary. He was a great conductor, much revered conductor by other conductors, as well as a composer. But he worked on Modern Times with Charlie Chaplin, or against Charlie Chaplin. This is one example of... And Charlie Chaplin, was an educated musician who couldn't do the dots. He played the fiddle and could write a bit of a tune. But so he had an amanuensis to do the orchestration for him. But Charlie Chaplin turned up for the session and started complaining. Started saying, that clarinet entry wasn't quite right. And Uncle Alfred took it for three or four times and then threw down his baton and walked off the platform and said, if you think it's crap, you fucking conduct it. And he swore he'd never work with Charlie Chaplin ever again, and he didn't. And they got an inferior conductor on the project. And if you listen to Modern Times, you can tell there are some shocking bad clarinet entries all the way through.
I've often noticed that. So who are the other ones here?
Right, he had three uncles. He comes from a sort of first generation... Well, his uncles came from first generation... The grandmother, their mother, Luba, was a first generation immigrant from the Ukraine. She had 10 sons, 10 children altogether, 6 sons, 4 daughters. 3 of the sons became hugely important Hollywood composers. That's Uncle Alfred, the most notable of them.
Emil.
That's Lionel there, isn't
it?
No,
that's Emil.
That's Lionel. That's Lionel over there. Lionel took over from Alfred as head of music at 20th Century Fox. He got his Oscar for... He was the musical director on Hello, Dolly. And he did a lot of television music when the studios folded in sort of the late 50s. 20th Century Fox really started doing a lot of television. He was the head of television music for that. That's Emil. Randy said that all of his uncles had massive, great Greek tragic flaws, but Uncle Emil, gambling, women, drink. Uncle Emil had them all. My favourite story about Uncle Emil is one day the orchestra was there waiting for Uncle Emil to turn up, and he hadn't turned up, and so a runner was sent to find him, and they found him in his dressing gown, sitting in front of his on the lawn in front of his house, and his house had just burned out, and all his clothes and all his possessions. And the runner said, "Emil, you've got to come to work." He said, "I'm quite drunk." He said, "So no, you've still got to come." So he came to work drunk, in his dressing gown, got up on the podium and did a day's work conducting, and did a fine job of it too. So Emil also worked with Randy on a lot of his albums.
That's Sail Away.
They're working on the Sail Away album.
So what was the effect of these, you know, these very powerful, you know, high profile senior men in the family on Randy?
Well, Randy used to go and to listen to the orchestras when they were being conducted by Alfred, and I think he was quite shocked because Alfred used to ask Randy's his opinion on things, and he saw that they were quite insecure, so he thought, is this the job for me? You know, I mean, but it is the family business,
right?
So it was just so easy for him to go into it,
right?
And also his father Irving, who was the doctor, really, really respected his brothers and wished, I think, that he'd gone into music himself.
Because he could have done, really, but he was the one picked to be at
do a proper job.
Yeah. Kind of thing. Just in case.
Yeah. In case it didn't work out. One of the things that really interests me, which you touch upon a bit in the book, is that this great tradition of American popular music, so much of it comes from Russian Jews.
Oh, absolutely.
It's extraordinary.
Gershwin.
Yeah, but even the same Shekel, not even...
not quite. I mean, they do come from all over the place a bit. But the Gershwins in between, say, 1881, which is when the big pogroms first started in Russia and Poland, and 1900. Dylan's grandparents, Zimmerman. Mr. and Mrs. Zimmerman. Yeah. The Gershwins came over. Irving Berlin came over. Richard Rodgers had been here a while. I think the Oscar Hammersteins came over. The Sondheims came over then, I think. They all came over and completely reinvented American music.
Yeah, just completely, absorbed themselves in this new tradition. Didn't
And many people have said it, but if you want to enumerate the Jews in early American popular music, the sort of Great American Songbook, it's much easier just to say, you can answer it in two words, which is Cole Porter, who is the only one who isn't Jewish. It is an extraordinary that they all, I mean, a lot of them came from the Ukraine, but some from Petersburg, some from Warsaw, which was then part of the Russian Empire.
Yeah.
But, not only that, but Samuel Goldwyn, the Warner Brothers, everybody who reinvented
a good book called An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
a really
good book. So
this is the first album. He's been styled.
Yes, isn't it? So when he finally gets to make an album, he goes studies music, doesn't he?
He went to UCLA.
So he did proper music.
Well, he dropped out before he graduated.
Right.
Because his teachers wouldn't let him do his final oral test in the style of Fats Domino.
Oh, see.
They thought it wasn't appropriate. But then, I mean, while he was still at college, he was writing songs. Lenny Waronker, who was his childhood friend, whose father, Cy Waronker, had played in Alfred's orchestra, then borrowed money from Alfred to start Liberty Records and brought his son, Lenny, into the business and put him to sort of run Metric Music, which was the publishing wing, the songwriting wing of Liberty. And Metric was where Sharon Sheely, who was in the car crash with Eddie Cochran, she was there. Jackie DeShannon, who did all those early Searchers hits, she was there. PJ Proby was there before he came to England, writing songs, much like the Brill Building, but not nearly as successful. And Randy started writing B-sides and album tracks for bands like the Fleetwoods and Victor Moan, and he did one for Frankie Lane, I think, but none of them were very successful. But then he started having hits in this country. His first big hit in this country was the Cilla Black Smile,
I've Been Wrong Before.
Also covered by Dusty.
Dusty did it as well. Cilla had the... And he did Just One Smile, which Dusty did, and he did Nobody Needs Your Love More with Gene Pitney.
And Simon Smith and the Amazing Dancing.
Well, that was a little bit later, his song started getting known and people started coming to... George Martin came to find him. To have a word with him to see what he'd got, because he'd been looking at his material, and tracked him down to the 20th Century Fox Music, where he was working as a music copyist for his uncle Lionel. He was sitting in the back, he was copying down music. But, he started having hits. I think the breakthrough for him as a songwriter, which led to him being a singer-songwriter, was...
it's going to rain.
I think it's going to rain. I always have to start songs from the beginning, and so I was going broken windows and empty hall. It's a long time before you get to the title. I think it's going to rain today, which Judy Collins had a hit with in '66, I think. Then that started a little bit more fame, and then Alan Price on his first album. I think there were four Randy Newman songs on that. And on Eric Burden's first solo album, I think there were four Randy Newman solo. So he started getting this cult name. Then Lenny got to work at, it's very complicated, Warner Brothers Records.
He was headhunted.
Warner became Reprise, and it gets very complicated, that story of what label, who's on when. Lenny Waronker, his childhood friend, became an A&R man at Warner Brothers and started assembling this team of geeks around him. He got Randy Newman. He got
Van Dyke Parks.
Ray Kuder a little bit later, yeah. And Leon Russell.
Yeah.
And they were sort of... Stan Cornyn, who was the publicity guy at Warner Brothers, described them as the high school geeks sitting in the corner of the library wishing they could go out with girls like the other boys. And Van Dyke Parks put out this incredibly... You must know it. Album called Song Cycle, which is incredibly dense.
So, if people in this room have got Song Cycle,
I'm sure they have, and I'm sure they play it every day for breakfast.
There you go. Hey. One, two. Yeah. Okay.
But it is an incredibly dense sort of, you know, heavyweight album in many, many respects. And Randy wrote one song on that and did some arrangement for it. But then it was Randy's turn, come up with your solo album, and he did it with an 80-piece orchestra, and it was called...
Because that's very much the style of this. This is the original cover. It's a polo neck shirt, and, you know...
That was the first album cover. It was originally called Randy Newman Creates Something New Under the Sun, and they shot him without his glasses and with, as you say, the Burt Bacharach polo neck on it.
He does look embarrassed, though, doesn't he?
As we say in the books, if you lay all the copies of Michael Jackson's Thriller end to end, they stretch. I think it's halfway around the world. If you lay all the copies of Randy Newman Creates Nothing New Under the Sun, it goes about from your house to the shops at the end of your road. It sold very, very badly. So Stan Cornyn, who was the publicity guy, gave it a new cover, which was rather moody and with the glasses and stuff like that. It still didn't sell, though.
But it began this intriguing relationship that Randy Newman's had with the record business ever since, which is always kind of... It's hopeless. I do all this stuff. I do what they ask me to. It never seems to work. That's his kind of position, isn't it?
Yeah, but the tagline they gave him was, "When his voice is really something when you get used to it." I mean, come on. Come up with something better.
Well, it's a kind of fair point, isn't it, really? Because, how do you feel about Randy Newman's voice, Caroline?
Oh, it's wonderful. I love Randy Newman. But it is, I will acknowledge, it's an acquired taste. I mean, it's been described as a frightened bison. And being compared to the sound of wet sand being eased out of a bottle.
Well, I think he's quoted in your book. He does a song very much later in his career, "Rider in the Rain," where he's backed by the Eagles.
Yeah,
he does these beautiful harmonies. And how does he describe? He says, "You know how I felt." Can you remember?
I can't remember. No, I don't think it is "Rider in the Rain." He describes using the Eagles on that. But later on, he's working with Jeff Lynne on something or other. I can't remember what it is. And the Eagles. And they said, "Right, let's do the backing vocals." And they all get round the mic and said, "Randy, come here." And Tom Petty's there as well. And... Randy said, "No, I can't do that sort of thing." And Tom Petty said, "No, I thought I couldn't do it until I did it with Jeff. But Jeff showed me how to do it. Jeff gives you the confidence. It's fine." So they all go, "Ooh." And Randy goes,
And then Jeff asked him to leave.
Jeff says, You're right.
Did he have a show at one point called it was billed as Randy Newman's Maybe I'm Doing It Wrong? And it ran for something like 17 nights. They billed it again as just Maybe I'm Doing It Wrong, with no mention of Randy Newman.
That's right.
It ran much more successful.
There have been very many attempts to marry Randy Newman with theatre, not least of which, of course, is his own Faust. He wrote his own musical. But there have been, lots of goes at doing sort of jukebox musicals of Randy Newman songs. None of them ever work. And I think that's possibly because if you do them on stage or act them or anything like that, they're in your face.
It's too much.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want is for Randy Newman songs to be in your face. When you listen to the records, and when he's doing them on stage to some extent, it's like he's letting you listen to them. He's leaving the door just a little bit ajar for you to peek around and say, "What's going on in there?" And it's up to you whether you actually open the door and go in or not. But it's a much more subtle thing. What's going on here? Oh, there he is.
We're talking about, how some of the first hits that he had were, from British artists. And Alan Price, foremost among them. And
really entertaining. That's brilliant.
I just couldn't resist this ad because, you know, I can remember when this record came out and I can remember hearing it and thinking, that's interesting, that's novel.
What did you think it was about?
I just thought it was about a bloke with a bear.
Oh, right. Yes.
I just did. And I've thought that about his songs ever since, you know, that they are what they are. And it's only later that you think, wow, how weird is that?
Yeah.
So then you're looking back at it, you think, he had a hit
with a song about a man with a dancer.
And he didn't explain it. Yeah. Here's the story. There's something about just the and it comes back to the point about the way he delivers them. And there's something just about the sheer catchiness of these things, isn't there? That they're in your memory before you know.
He does a good tune.
He does.
And he is so much in that tradition of great tunes. I mean, he knows show tunes. He knows Americana. He knows Stephen Foster. His musicality is unimpeachable. Unimpeachable is the word.
You've got an interesting quote in the book from Mitchell Froom, the great producer who subsequently produced Crowd of the House and Richard Thompson. And he says, usually when I'm in the studio, I know more about music than anybody else in the studio. When I'm in the studio with Randy Newman, I keep my trap shut.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I don't know anything like what he knows. You know. Yeah. Because he always says, you know, who do you admire? He always says Schubert.
Yeah.
No?
Schubert and Fats Domino.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes he'll allow Mendelssohn a word or two.
Yeah, okay.
Not many other people.
No.
He never says Aaron Copland. And a lot of people compare his music to Aaron Copland. But other people have mentioned, they're just working from the same source. They're working from that great source of American folk song, and they're similar just because they're both working from the same source.
I wanted to talk about this because this is one of his first kind of key credits, wasn't it? It was a bit of a breakthrough, Caroline, for him. This is 1967, is this Piggy Bailey record?
I mean, he just arranged it, didn't he?
Yeah.
And Peggy Lee was the person who wanted it.
She'd heard it. So she was kind of past it, really. A career
she was
at
looking
Stall.
For, yeah,
but she was looking around and she'd found this Randy, guy, Randy Newman, and thought. And she was the person who suggested to Lieber and Stoller that he might be a good person to arrange it.
Lieber and Stoller had done a whole album for her, which is a tremendous. If you've never heard Peggy Lee's Mirrors, get hold of it. It is a fantastic album, and it is an elderly. Well, she wasn't elderly, she was about 35, I suppose, which was, elderly in those sort of terms. And she hadn't had a hit for about 10 years.
She had a bottle of brandy in her bag.
Lieber and Stoller wrote her this album of songs about being old, basically. They are strange songs. And one of them is That All There Is, and it's got a fantastic Randy Newman arrangement on. And apparently she turned up to the studio to do the session, and she was a bit wooden on the first one. By take four, the brandy bottle came out, and she started having a few pulls. And then everybody started drinking. And then take 36 happened. Oh, but she'd said in advance, I'm only going to do two takes, and then I'm out of here. Yeah. Take 36 came, and she was just getting comfortable with the lyric and the feel of the song. And Lieber and Stoller were in the gallery, and they said, that's it, that's the one, that's absolutely one. And the tape op said, oh, did you want me to press record? So the one that went on the record is take 37, which is quite good, but as they said, nowhere near as good as the lost take 30s.
So this is kind of a big breakthrough for him, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know. That cover actually is terrible, isn't it? Jan and Dean.
It's endearingly terrible, isn't it?
But it was Jan and Dean did the artwork.
Oh, it was Dean Torrance, wasn't it?
Dean Torrance,
But, you know, that was sort of saying he can't sing these songs himself.
Yeah.
Surely that would be insane. Yeah. Let's get this sweet voice.
Yeah.
No, it
was Harry Nilsson's idea. Yeah. I mean, Harry Nilsson adored Randy Newman songs. He had terrific taste. So he decided, this was 69, was it? 69, 70, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
He decided he wanted to do a whole album just of Randy Newman songs called Nilsson Sings Newman. And since nobody in the world had heard of Randy Newman by this point, it was quite a brave thing to do. And it was also an extraordinary album.
It's a great record.
It's a fabulous record, yeah. According to Harry Nilsson's wife, and according to Alan, which is where we got this information from, she reckons this is the point at which Harry Nilsson started doing a lot of cocaine. And you can hear it on the record. I mean, the grandiosity of his arrangements. It's basically, it's just Randy playing piano and Harry Nilsson singing, and then Harry Nilsson singing, and Harry Nilsson singing, and Harry Nilsson singing, overdubbing and overdubbing and overdubbing. These massive choirs. In fact, one of the execs said, don't you think you should give credit to the backing vocalists? They've done an awful lot of work. I mean... But it's also got this very strange sort of postmodern thing on it, which is a lot of the comments to the tape op and the engineers
yes.
are in there. Says, could I have a bit in the middle of a you know this huge chorus? You just have this voice say, could I have a bit more of my present vocal in the headphones, please? And these strange little comments that make it odd.
It's a wonderful, wonderful record, yeah. But bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, to listen to the Beehive State.
Yeah,
this is just. You know, there is no record like this. You know, I recommend everybody go home and listen to it. But Randy's, yeah. I suppose, I can remember buying this record in 1972 at Opus Records in Palmer's Green on my way home from a Jay Giles Band concert. And, you know, I knew that Randy Newman was the person I kind of approved of, you know, because I'd heard, you know, no, I think it's going to rain today and all these kind of things. And I sat down and played... You know, my girlfriend.
Did you cry at all?
and you know, and I didn't understand it really.
No, that's the extraordinary thing about this song is a lot of people listen to it and have no idea what it's about.
Well,
they're just
well, it comes yeah, sort of
a song
there
about
aren't very many
about slavery,
songs about,
basically.
Yeah, but from the point of a slave trader, yes. Not even from the slave.
Yes, a slave trader selling, advertising, yeah. Marketing the idea of coming to America as the dream.
Because it's great, you get watermelons to eat, and,
that's
and
right.
You can run about, and you don't scuff your feet. It's an incredible.
It's extraordinary.
Record. Yeah,
but it's also set. I mean, it is this brutally. Clive James in one of his reviews in Cream.
He's got a really good quote.
But he also calls him the horse foreman of the apocalypse, which I think is very good. But he says that Randy is the master of the vocabulary of insensitivity.
I think that's so true.
Fantastic quote. And Sail Away is a fine example of that, but it started with a film idea that him and Elton John and Chris Christopherson, I think it was, that somebody came up with this idea, we'll do three films and you can have one each and you can do what you like. And Randy came up with this idea of playing a slave trader going to America, but talking the slaves onto the boat by selling America by selling the American dream to Africans. And it ended up with this. And it has the thing about it is that when you listen to the song, you think, I wouldn't mind being a slave. It sounds really, really good. And musically, I mean, the opening, that horns and woodwind in the open, it is just straightforward. You know, get your hankies out.
And also it was covered beautiful. By loads of people, wasn't it? I mean, the Ron Stant and so forth.
Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee did a version of it.
Yeah, which must have been from a different perspective.
Yeah, obviously.
One hopes,
And they do it with a banjo, I think, and the, you know, the Sonny Terry
harmonica.
And Ray Charles does a version of it as well. There are some extraordinary covers, and each cover of it is a sort of slightly different take on the song. It's fabulous.
But you somehow can't take it seriously coming from anybody other than Randy Newman, can you? You think within the it's the mind of Randy Newman, isn't it? You
know, and
if you buy the mind of Randy Newman, you buy the song, don't you?
Yeah. If you buy the mind, if everybody bought the mind of Randy Newman, the world would be a much better place then, because it's a mind that can absorb contradiction. It can absorb. It's a very, very, very intelligent mind, and they're very, very, very intelligent songs. They're songs about nothing's quite what it seems. In fact, as soon as you start talking about the songs and describing what they do and how they work, you just feel stupid because you have to listen to them and you have to absorb them. But they I mean, people call them ironic songs, but irony just doesn't cover it. Irony is not deep enough for what they do. They are... they are songs of many, many different levels, and they are very funny songs very often, or very deeply funny songs.
But you make the point that the ones that are ironic sort of produce two audiences. There's the audience that don't really understand it, and then there's the other audience that do understand it, also rather enjoy the fact that the other audience don't understand
exactly.
it. You're rather smug about it.
I mean, if you are a middle-class New York or L.A. or London liberal, then you know they allow you to feel fantastically smug because you get them and lots of other people do. But then he'll kick
he
you in the...
He undercuts it. Yeah. Well, in a song like Rednecks, I mean, you know the song.
Oh, yes. And I mean, a friend of mine saw him play that down in New Orleans, and there were people there whooping along with the chorus because they actually thought that they completely misunderstood the song.
Yeah, because it starts by kicking the South in the teeth and then just turns the whole song around and starts kicking the North in the teeth and thinking, you think you're so smug. But he also used to go on the bitter end when he started performing live, and he'd do old, essentially racist songs like Under the Harlem Moon just to sort of frighten his audience. They're all sitting there in their smug liberal sensitivity going, it's Randy Newman, we're in on this joke, and those people outside, you know, on the street, they're not. And then he'd do Under the Harlem... how many levels of irony can my brain cope with before it explodes that here he is doing that?
One of the songs on Sail Away is It's Lonely at the Top. I think it's on Sail Away, isn't it?
It's on his live album.
He always talks about trying to... I always wanted Frank Sinatra to do that song. He still says that. I listened to It's Lonely at the Top. I think Frank Sinatra was never going to do that song. Forever.
But he always loved the idea that he would... He did pitch it to Frank Sinatra. And then he pitched it to Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
And Barbara Streisand said... It always reminds me of a great line of Victoria Coren's, actually. Barbara Streisand said, "People might think I mean it." The song, if you don't know it, is about I've been around the world, had my pick of any girl. You'd think I'd be happy, but I'm not. Deep down, it's about it's the same story as Gene Pitney's Backstage. You know, I'm a big star and I've got loads and loads of money, but really I'm very unhappy. And Barbara Streisand said, "But people might think I mean it." And it was Victoria Coren tells this story about a boyfriend that she once had, who said, "The trouble with you is you say things you don't mean just because they're funny." And Victoria Coren said, "It's the first time it ever occurred to her that some people say things that aren't funny just because they mean them." And that was very much Randy's. Reaction to Barbara Streisand's reaction to singing, "People might think I mean it." And he started thinking, is that what I'm supposed to do? Write songs I mean? And then you've got that terrible problem. He says, well, what do I mean? And what he means is exactly what he says. He means all the complications of the human brains that every human brain has got, all these contradictions and difficulties and cross. If you're going to honestly reflect the human brain, you have to incorporate all those things somehow, which is why it's not really irony.
No, we come to this, which is, a record that you couldn't make nowadays.
You'd simply not be allowed to
put it out. Yeah. You know, Warner Brothers or whoever owns them would not put that record out nowadays. Yeah. You wouldn't get it on playing on the radio anywhere at all.
Yeah.
It came out in whatever it came out, the mid-70s, and we all just went, it's Randy Newman. It's about the South, the Southern states.
And again, very, very complicated songs.
Yes.
I can't remember. When he sings Good Old Boys live now, does he say
Rednecks.
The word?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't do it now.
He doesn't do it at all.
Sure he doesn't dare do it.
No.
But he justifies it. I mean, he said that... what's the quote? He says there's a very... He uses the N-word liberally. The first song does, and it's written from the point of view of a Southern racist, and who then starts laying into the North as being more racist than the South is. And it was inspired by seeing Dick Cavett's show that had Lester Maddox, who was then the governor of Georgia, on it. And Dick Cavett, basically just made fun of Lester Maddox and Lester Maddox's racism, and Lester Maddox walked off the show. And You know, Randy was no fan of Lester Maddox, but on the other hand, he thinks he thought that this
he
was
thinks everybody should get a song, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, yeah. He thought this was a terrible way of treating a human being. You know, that just to bring him on a TV show and then to mock him. What you know, what sort of?
But he was the governor of Georgia.
Yeah, he was the governor of Georgia.
And
he
people
was the elective,
voted him.
Yeah, and so just the opening, the anger. In that opening, which is last night, I saw Lester Maddox on a TV show with some smart-ass New York Jew, and the Jew laughed at Lester Maddox, and the audience laughed at Lester Maddox, and he starts spitting these words out, and then he gets, you know, into the chorus, and he gets worse and worse and worse. But then he turns the whole song round, and it's about, you think you're so clever, you up there in the North. You think racism only exists down in the... in the South, but you know, in the North, they're all free. They're free to be locked up in Roxburgh, but, and just names all the ghettos where they have these terrible troubles.
But in the world of social media, it's even more impossible to play songs like that
because
one tiny misunderstanding.
I know the world has gone. City. Whenever the song that just lives in my head the whole time is a song called Mikey's, which is from one of his lesser known songs from what's it on? Is it on Land of Dreams? I can't remember.
Yeah, the Little Criminals.
Which has just got that great line at the end of it. And when I sit among people here tonight, and when I went to see Randy Newman, when we went to see Randy Newman at the Royal Festival Hall, and you see the people in the audience. And you look around and say, these are the same people I've been going to gigs with since 1962. You know, these are all the same people who were at the, you know, Rykuda Chicken Skin Music thing at the Hammersmith Odeon. And I always want to go up to everybody and just sit there at the end and say, whatever happened to the fucking Duke of Earl? Which is the last line of... And it is just, whatever happened to those great songs that they used to have, the old days, whatever happened to your own youth, whatever happened to the fucking Duke of Earl? Sorry. But anyway, where did that come from? Sorry.
This is him, you know, in the studio, where he's at his happiest, surrounded by, you know, an orchestra, you know, doing the same work, really, that his legendary uncles did.
Yeah, I mean, he started doing film music. Well, he was writing bits of film music for his uncle Lionel in the 60s. He was writing for those TV shows that we've all forgotten,
Peyton
like
Place.
Peyton Place and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and things like that. But then he started his first... He should have been writing... movie music from about 1968, but he blew a very important interview where he went to an interview with a big-time film producer. And the big-time film, play us something, what you've been writing lately. So he'd just written a song that he was very proud of, quite rightly, called Davy the Fat Boy.
Oh,
and he started playing Davy the Fat Boy and then sort of...
This is an extremely corpulent character.
Yes.
Yeah,
the producer weighed about 300 pounds and the producer was also bald. He says, have you got any songs about bald guys? And so Randy didn't write film music for quite a while. He did a very bad film called Cold Turkey, which was about a whole village, that whole town that decides to give up smoking for a bet.
Oh, yes.
Which you know, you don't count. Then his first big movie was Ragtime.
Right.
And he then got this reputation as being the guy, the go-to guy if you wanted sensitive Americana in your movie. So he did Atonement, he did Awakenings. He did a lot of quite very sensitive films. And here he is, happy as Larry. He loves orchestras. He loves conducting, just like his Uncle Alfred did. Oh, there's Baltimore.
But it fascinates me about Randy Newman is he collects the stories of the little disasters, like playing David the Fat Boy to the fat executive.
Yes.
And he reels them out endlessly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not boringly, but just, you know, this is my story. This is how I tell my story. It's a succession of disasters.
Yes.
You know, so Baltimore, he wrote this...
He wrote something about Baltimore, which is not that flattering, really. But
having not
visited...
He'd never been there.
Yeah.
It's not like what's happening to Potty Harvey in Washington, D.C.
He'd driven through, I think, once.
Yeah.
and the city of Baltimore got quite cross, didn't they? And the mayor of Baltimore, when he played, eventually he played Baltimore.
Played Baltimore.
And
it's all about hookers on the corner.
He had to apologise to Miss Baltimore.
That's right. They had Miss Baltimore on stage, and he had to publicly apologise.
You feel like Randy Newman's had to apologise to just about everywhere in the United States.
You know, short people was...
Well, yes, there you are.
There it is, there's short people.
So here's my question. If Randy Newman, you know, we hope he has a long and productive life still to come, but when he does eventually hand in his lunch pile, what does it say on the headline of the New York Times? Does it say short people singer?
Yeah.
It's a serious point. And I'm sure...
Famous bigot dies.
See, John Humphreys, I was watching this, I looked at this on YouTube the other day when somebody went on Mastermind answering questions on the life and work of Randy Newman. The opening line John Humphreys comes up with, isn't he a bit of a bigot? Which is just staggering.
And that's John Humphreys.
Yeah. No, actually, because he has got, well, of course, now one more famous song than that.
Which we'll come to.
All right.
So,
okay, yeah.
So will it be...
No, it'll be the other one that you haven't come to, and we're keeping a secret, okay, apparently. No. Just to eke out the mystery. Look, they're on the edges of their seats.
No, it's just interesting, because in the end, you are... You know, in obituaries, they're very often reduced to one line, aren't they? You know, Harry Nilsson would have been everybody's talking.
Beatles were always the Hey Jude hitmakers.
Yes. It would be. And whereas this, you know, he just came up with the song and he thought, well, that might do quite well. And it did far better than he...
It went to number two in the Billboard chart, number one in the Cash
Board
chart.
And he spent the rest of his life
regretting.
Isn't he regretting?
It was the hit from hell, is what he used to call it.
If you don't know the story, he wrote this song, which is about prejudice and bigotry.
It's about short people.
Yeah, exactly. And he thought that there was a movie called The Boy with Green Hair, which, you know, you think of something that you can use that you can, so you can sing or talk about bigotry without having to talk about Jewish people or black people or, you know, or one of the stuff. So you're not sort of bogged down with the weight of the reality. So he just picked on short people as the most absurd thing that anybody could be bigoted about. And, you know, we were talking about irony where there's an inside crowd and an outside crowd. A lot of the outside crowd were under 5'6", and some of them had guns. They did. It was a while. He said it was a while before he could walk through an airport and feel completely safe.
But the fact is that if that comes on the radio when you're going home tonight in your car, you're going to go, shoot.
Short people got no reason to live.
It's a song.
Yeah.
It's not a poem.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it requires you to be involved in it, doesn't it?
But it still gets the anger. It's still there. It's on YouTube, and if you look at the comments underneath the YouTube, you say, this song destroyed my life, you know, all that stuff.
It's the grand tradition of Money for Nothing and Born in the USA.
Yeah, exactly,
and
limitless. Yeah. Oh, there it is.
So, you know, by contrast, you know, he latterly, well, I say latterly, it's probably the last 20 years now, he's become the kind of... the go-to guy for the Pixar animations.
And other animations in DreamWorks.
With
done as
enormous
well.
Success.
Yeah.
How do you think he approaches this kind of work? And this doesn't have the ironical part of his brain engaged, or does it?
When he says he's going to sing You've Got a Friend in Me, he always says, you haven't got a friend in me. It's a cartoon. That's what he does. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So he distances himself from the sentiment of the song.
Yeah.
I think that the reason he's so good at this is exactly what we were talking about before, is his grasp of musical styles. If you listen to any cue from Toy Story or Monsters, Inc., the number of musical styles it goes through just in one single cue. You know, there'll be two bars of Schubert and then two bars of Gershwin and then three bars of Duke Ellington and then a bit of Bach and then a bit of, you know, crazy ragtime and whatever. And he's just the master of all these. And he doesn't like particularly doing cartoons because it's hard work. He says the thing about writing a thing like Atonement or Awakenings is there's a lot of very slow passages. So you write a whole note there and a whole note there, and you've got a whole page of music done, and there's a 5-minute cue, and it's only got about five notes on the page because they're sustained. Cartoons is all that. Is, you know, loads and loads of quarter notes and eighth notes, and it's dense with notes. It's just a lot of writing involved. But he was good at it, and he got the gig because John Lasseter was a Randy Newman fan. John Lasseter, the director, and, well, he runs Pixar, didn't he, was a big Randy Newman fan, and everybody said, who are you going to get to the music? So, Randy Newman, and people said, well, he does Awakenings and Atonement. And those
hero music.
Yeah, he does hero music for The Natural and stuff like that. And so, no, he'll be all right. And he was.
He's done well out of well-placed fans throughout his career.
Yeah. Harry Nilsson, John Lasseter, Lenny Waronker.
There's a thing the other night I was looking at when John Stewart, what's his name? The other American late night guy who just stopped doing late night, I can't remember. Anyway.
Oh, John Thing. Yeah.
Guy who pretends to be the right-wing politician, remember.
John Thing.
Anyway, when he was doing his last show, they got in Randy Newman. Yeah. To play the piano while the choir of celebrities trooped on, you know, famous newsreaders, Michael Stipe or whatever. Yeah. How is Randy Newman referred to in the voiceover on the news? Soft rock superstar. it's just kind of classic.
He was on an episode of Ally McBeal. Do you remember Ally McBeal with Callista Flockhart? Which always sounds to me like the disease of a sheep's liver. It's got Callista Flockhart. We're going to have to put it down. He was on an episode of Ally McBeal. It was the last one of the season, and they did Ally McBeal, the musical, where they used a lot of Randy Newman, or bits of Randy Newman songs throughout it, and he was at the end playing piano and singing something. And I love his comment at the end of it. He was only there for about 10 minutes just to do his bit. He was there for a morning, and he said, he shook hands with the director at the end and says, it's been a difficult season, but thank God we've come through it. But then afterwards, he said, I was the fattest person those people had ever seen.
No, he went to an Oscar. Didn't he go to an Oscars event once? And he had something like, Julia Roberts in front of him and Johnny Depp behind him or something. He said, I felt invisible. It was just the idea that he doesn't stand out.
It's always his whole thing is, what am I doing here?
That's his whole shtick. My life has been a complete failure.
What am I doing here? Yeah. And another wonderful example of this, which again I do recommend on YouTube, if you look at the great disastrous Brits with Sam Fox and Mick Fleetwood.
Yeah.
What's the musical turn right at the very end of the disaster at the Albert Hall? It's Randy Newman saying, falling in love with the Mark Knopfler Brit supergroup. And all the way, Randy Newman's going, what am I doing here? And all the people at home are watching and think, who's that bloke? You know, what's got him here?
But he always plays the outsider.
Yes.
If he was asked which of one of these characters that he really identified with, he said Jesse.
Yeah.
He's still that geeky schoolboy who none of the girls would
I wanted to finish with this because I'm fascinated by Randy Newman and his families. This is his
second his family.
Second
that's,
family.
That's Gretchen and
Alice and
so he first married.
He first married Ross Wether. He always marries Germans. nobody knows why, least of all him. But he married Ross Wether and they lived in. He's always lived in the same, pretty much the same neighbourhood, Pacific Palisades in Los Angeles, and he's a very good, happy family man. They brought up three boys, and then they decided to get divorced, and it was a fantastically sort of amicable divorce. And then he met Gretchen, and he married Gretchen. And when they were on holiday, when they were on their honeymoon in Italy, Randy said to Gretchen, would you like to meet Ross Wether? Because she's ever so nice. And so she said, that'd be all right. So Ross Wether and Gretchen went out for dinner together and got on really well. And then when Randy and Gretchen bought a new house, Ross Wether's husband, her second husband, designed it. Was the interior designer who did the house for them. So it's all very friendly, and the kids all.
And then finished up writing a song.
Well, that's the song. You see,
exactly.
Is the unique in my experience. This is unique.
I don't.
For somebody to write a song about their ex-wife.
Yeah.
Called "I Miss You."
Yeah. While he's still married to the second wife.
Did he confer with his second wife and say, "I'm going to do this," or did he just put it out?
His second wife. She didn't mind him recording it, but she said when he plays live, he's not allowed to sing it in LA. Because the neighbours might hear. Yeah.
So. But I just think that's the ultimate Randy Newman song. It's kind of oddly candid.
It's got the key...
It's, I miss you, I'm sorry, but I do.
The key line in it is, I always told you I'd sell my soul and your soul for a song. Yeah. He'll do anything for a song. So he doesn't care who gets hurt, who gets trodden on.
Yeah. He's honest.
He's honest, yeah. It's a brutal sort of honesty. Yeah.
It is. And, you know, it's kept him fascinating for, you know...
Absolutely. And
45
long may it
years.
Continue to do so.
And long may it continue. Yeah. And you know, this is a terrific, you know, examination of that life and that extraordinary music of the man with no antecedents and no successors. And I don't know if we've got any copies of this book here.
We've only got four with us, unfortunately.
Okay.
So fight for them.
I don't know if our publishers brought a secret stock. But
but if you want to ask David and Caroline any questions, I'm sure they'd be happy to answer them outside in the bar. Thank you very much indeed for coming. And we shall think about doing further duos in the future. Simon and Garfunkel.
Yes.
You know. Charles and Eddie, whatever. But would you please say thank you to Dave and Caroline Safford.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much for having us.
I'll just briefly, Alex, when is the next one? Has he gone away? It's in June.
He's running.
June 20th. We got Sylvia Patterson, who's written a book called I'm Not With the Band.
Yeah, it's terrific.
And we've got the great Derek Ridges, photographer famous street photographer of punk rock stars and New Romantics and so forth, talking about his book Punk London 1977. And that's June 20th, is that right? Further details in due course. Thank you very much indeed for coming. Cheers.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.